Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, a monster winter storm is expected to bring frigid temperatures, heavy snow, and dangerous ice to more than 200 million people across the country.
Images of a five-year-old boy being detained by ICE in Minnesota trigger outrage. We speak to his school superintendent.
There are very many ICE agents right now in our community. They are driving around our schools, circling our schools. They are at our bus stops, following our buses.
And TikTok's parent company finalizes a deal to avoid a ban that would affect millions of users in the United States. Welcome to the NewsHour. More than half of the nation is bracing for what's expected to be an historic weekend winter storm, one posing dangerous travel conditions, thousands of canceled flights, likely power outages, and serious risks of hypothermia.
Between now and Monday, the storm will span more than 2,000 miles from Texas to New England, pummeling more than two dozen states along the way with a combination of freezing rain, ice, and snow.
Across much of the country, salt trucks are stocking up and snow plows stand at the ready. Many states are pre-treating roads ahead of what's expected to be a massive and menacing winter storm. At least a dozen states have already declared weather emergencies.
No state will be immune from feeling the effect of Mother Nature's wrath on this weekend.
What is being predicted right now, whether it's a foot of snow or even a little bit more, would be one of the biggest snowfalls that our city has seen in years.
Forming today across the Central Plains, the storm will trudge thousands of miles across the country before arriving in Maine by Sunday. More than a foot of snow could fall in places in the north. The south will see freezing rain and sleet. Almost 180 million Americans are under winter watches and warnings.
And it'll be a significant snow.
The chief meteorologist for AccuWeather.
There are many communities that are not typically used to dealing with this magnitude of snow and ice that are going to be having to contend with that.
Setting the stage, Arctic air that is pushing even farther south, putting more than 200 million Americans under alerts for extreme cold. With wind chill tonight, it will feel below zero everywhere from the Texas Panhandle to the Midwest and New England.
You better bundle up. You'll be experiencing minus 40 to minus 50 degree wind chills.
Much of the country will stay below freezing well into next week, meaning the snow and ice will not melt. That could strain electric grids and lead to widespread power outages. The storm is also expected to paralyze travel. Nearly 2,000 flights across the country were either delayed or canceled today in advance of the storm. And officials warned people to avoid driving.
I am asking all Virginians to stay off the roads as of Saturday night, all day Sunday, through Monday morning. This will allow not only for the safety and security of our neighbors, but it will allow for faster clearing of roads.
Preparing to hunker down, many people have already stocked up on food and supplies, others finding store shelves empty.
We may be a little bit early, but we're trying to beat the crowd, I guess. And I used to live in Florida. We used to do that all the time for hurricane season, so it's not so different.
Hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. Schools from Chicago to Houston canceled classes today, and many school districts across the country are preparing for snow days or remote learning next week.
In the day's other headlines, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is calling President Trump's comments about NATO troops serving in Afghanistan insulting and appalling. During an interview on the sidelines of the Davos World Economic Forum yesterday, Trump said of NATO member nations, quote, they'll say they sent some troops to Afghanistan. They stayed a little back, a little off the front lines. Speaking today, Starmer pointed out that more than 150,000 British troops served in Afghanistan in the years after the U.S.-led invasion in 2001, and more than 450 died.
If I had misspoken in that way or said those words, I would certainly apologize. And I'm not surprised they've caused such hurt to the loved ones of those who were killed or injured.
Meantime, in another fallout from Davos, President Trump has withdrawn his invitation to Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney to join his Board of Peace. That comes after Carney delivered a stark speech in Switzerland in which he warned about what he called the rupture in the world order. He called on so-called middle powers like Canada to band together to adapt to the new global reality. In Abu Dhabi, diplomats from Ukraine, Russia, and the U.S. met today for talks on ending the nearly four-year war in Ukraine. The gathering was the first time on record that officials from the Trump administration have sat down with both countries at once. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the future of Ukraine's eastern Donbass region will be key to any success in the talks. Russian leader Vladimir Putin has called on Kyiv to withdraw its troops from such areas. The White House described today's talks as productive and said conversations would continue into the weekend. The FBI says it has arrested Ryan Wedding, a former Olympic snowboarder and alleged drug kingpin. Officials say the 44-year-old oversaw a multinational cocaine operation running from Colombia through Mexico and into the U.S. and Canada. They say he also orchestrated a number of witness killings to keep it going. Wedding was one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, a far cry from his former life as a snowboarder representing his native Canada in the 2002 Winter Olympics. Today, FBI Director Kash Patel said Wedding was apprehended in Mexico last night, where he'd been hiding for the past decade.
He's a modern-day El Chapo. He is a modern-day Pablo Escobar. And he thought he could evade justice. And here we are today, bringing him to justice for trafficking hundreds of kilos of cocaine, and also for the murder of innocent civilians.
Canadian police say Wedding also faces separate drug trafficking charges there that date back to 2015. Vice President J.D. Vance rallied anti-abortion activists in Washington, D.C. today as part of the annual March for Life.
We have made tremendous strides over the last year, and we're going to continue to make strides over the next 3 years to come.
Vance cited the expansion of a ban on funding for U.S. foreign aid groups that support abortion services, and he emphasized the importance of boosting the nation's birth rates, just days after he and wife Usha announced they're expecting their fourth child. The event also included a video address from President Trump, followed by the march itself. The mood was largely upbeat, though some activists have called for the administration to do more to crack down on abortion pills like mifepristone. The city of Philadelphia is suing the Trump administration over the removal of a slavery exhibit at the Independence National Historical Park. Yesterday, National Park Service crews removed display panels from the president's house, where George Washington once lived, that commemorated people enslaved there by his family. The Interior Department cited President Trump's executive order aimed at, quote, restoring truth and sanity to American history. Today, handmade signs covered the space where the panels hung with messages that read, "Learn all history, and history is real." On Wall Street today, stocks ended mixed after a week dominated by talk of tariffs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 300 points on the day. The Nasdaq managed a gain of about 65 points. The S&P 500 added just 2 points, so basically flat. And Trinity Rodman is now reportedly the highest-paid women's soccer player in the world. The 23-year-old forward signed a 3-year deal with the Washington Spirit, where she started her career. It's valued at an estimated $2 million per year when counting in bonuses. The deal comes amid a broader legal fight over salary caps in the National Women's Soccer League. In a statement, Rodman said, quote, "We're chasing championships and raising the standard, and I can't wait to keep doing that with my teammates." Rodman has scored 11 goals and 47 appearances for the national team, more than any other player on the roster. Still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. A surge of new measles cases raises worrying questions about the drop in vaccination rates. And a new book explores a 1980s New York subway shooting that defined an era.
This is the PBS NewsHour from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, headquarters of PBS News.
The Trump administration's immigration crackdown and ICE surge in the Twin Cities drew large protests today.
It was part of a general strike and walkout backed by labor leaders and faith groups. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro begins our coverage with this report from Minneapolis.
Ice out! Ice out!
Thousands of people braved bone-chilling temperatures this afternoon for a rally in downtown Minneapolis, protesting what they call a siege of the Twin Cities by federal agents. For many here and throughout the Twin Cities, Renee Nicole Good has become an icon. The 37-year-old mother of three was shot by an ICE officer in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago. Her image now appears widely throughout the Twin Cities. Annie Rose co-owns the Lost Fox, a downtown St. Paul cafe that's a quiet refuge from all the tension outside.
Renee Good is the face of it. It's a face that people can feel comfortable with. She's a woman, she was a mother, she was white. You know, and it's something that we can come back to and say, you know, oh, they came for my neighbors and then they came for me. Well, that is something that we can all, like, resonate with.
Today, she closed the place, even though it's tough to lose a Friday evening's revenue in the slowest month of the year, she says.
It's already hard out here. Every January, I take out a no-interest credit card to make sure I can make payroll. This year, I'm going to probably have to pay interest on that credit card.
Across the metro area, hundreds of small businesses, especially restaurants, heeded a call to observe a general strike, many in sympathy with immigrant-owned shops where business has plummeted sharply amid fears of ICE patrols. Schools in the area also closed today. Labor unions led the call for the general strike, but the decision was made easier by today's life-threatening low temperatures. Still, Annie Rose said she felt compelled to brace them.
It's all fear-based. You're afraid to go to rallies, whether it's cold, you're afraid to go to rallies because you don't want to be shot. You're afraid to stand up for things because of fear. And how can you live your life if you're constantly in fear? It's important to show my kids that, no, you can stand up for what you believe in.
Protesters marched about a mile through downtown Minneapolis to the indoor basketball arena. The DHS gave no signs today of easing up on its surge on the Twin Cities in the days ahead. On Thursday, Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino was asked if there's a number of arrests agents were targeting.
There is a number, and it's called all of them.
DHS Secretary Kristi Noem said 10,000, quote, criminal illegal aliens have been arrested here, a sharp spike from the start of the week when the agency put the figure at 3,000. But the department has released details of far fewer cases, which it calls the worst of the worst. All this comes at a time of rising public scrutiny. ICE officers detained a 5-year-old boy on Tuesday during an immigration enforcement operation. At a press conference today, Marcos Charles, the head of ICE's deportation branch, said the boy was being cared for.
We do everything in our power not to separate families. So they took him back together to Minneapolis, here to the city, to the ICE facility for processing, and now they are being well cared for at a family residential center.
This is what community looks like.
On Thursday, three prominent civic activists were arrested after an anti-ICE protest at a St. Paul church. The White House later posted an AI-manipulated image of one woman to its social media account. When asked about the image, Kaylin Dorr, the White House Deputy Communications Director, wrote, "Enforcement of the law will continue. The memes will continue." At a separate anti-ICE rally today, roughly 100 people, including members of clergy, were arrested after protesting outside a terminal at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport.
I am slowly losing hope, and that is a problem, and that's what keeps me up at night. But then I go to rallies, like you asked why I'm going to go to the rally, and that is to see hope in process.
For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSam-Lazaro in Minneapolis.
As we've seen, the ICE operations in the Twin Cities are also affecting children who are caught up in the surge of personnel and detentions. Our Liz Landers joins us now with that part of the story. Liz?
Thanks, Jeff. The 5-year-old boy, Liam, that Fred mentioned in his report was a student in the Columbia Heights School District. Superintendent Zena Stenvik joins me now. Zena, thank you so much for joining NewsHour this evening. What is your understanding of what happened to Liam when he was detained earlier this week?
My understanding is that there were bystanders, community members, school officials, and another adult who actually lives in the home, asking to keep Liam, that they would take Liam, that they would take care of him and get him safely to family members, and that they that didn't happen. They weren't allowed to do that. And instead, he was pretty quickly, within hours, flown to Texas to a detention center.
The Homeland Security Department is giving a different version of what happened when he was detained. A spokeswoman claims that Liam was abandoned by his family and his mother refused to take custody of him when agents knocked on the door. Here's Customs and Border Patrol official Greg Bovino when he was asked about this specific case earlier today.
Some of you had questions on the five-year-old yesterday. That five-year-old remains with his family. We say again, remains with his family. We know that. That false media narrative that was pushed out yesterday was, well, it was false. It remains with his family.
He's now being held at a federal processing facility in Dilley, Texas, which you mentioned. And I will add that NewsHour had a conversation about that facility earlier this week. There is contaminated food there. There's limited access to drinking water and inadequate medical care there, according to a lawsuit that's been filed. What is your response to what the administration is saying?
He's in a detention center. A five-year-old is being held in a detention center. I have a real problem with that. I know that his preschool classroom is a beautiful, wonderful environment. I have been in his home where it was, you know, he has a backyard where he can play and build snowmen with his older brother. And, you know, when I was in the home, there were plenty of toys around and, you know, just a really nice environment for a child to live in. It was, you know, a far cry from, I hate to think about what he's actually experiencing right now, what the conditions could possibly be given the lawsuit that's out there. You know, as I mentioned, I was on scene. I was there shortly after Liam was taken. I've been in the home. I've talked to the mother. The people claiming that she abandoned her child is so far from the truth. We have to remember that she had another child on the way home from school. And we also have to remember that there were eight armed and masked agents swarming all around the house and the driveway and the car. So a very intense situation. She was asked to not open the door by her husband, who was in the driveway in handcuffs. And, you know, it just all around a tense situation. We have... unfortunately, at this point now, for those of us living in the Twin Cities, it's very common knowledge that ICE agents are bursting through doors. If you crack open the door a little bit, they're bursting through into apartments, apprehending people. They're even breaking down doors and leaving broken doors or no doors now. So, you know, opening the door with ICE agents looming, it's not as easy or as clean of a statement as one might suggest.
There are some conflicting reports about whether the family is here legally. Federal officials say that they are not, but a family attorney says that they are pursuing a legal asylum pathway. Does that matter for education purposes in your school district?
No, I mean, there's federal case law. We are, and under the, you know, Minnesota Constitution, we educate children regardless of legal status. So when children enroll in our school district, we're actually not even allowed to ask their legal status. But I will tell you, as I mentioned, I was in the home and I saw the legal documentation with my own eyes.
There are a number of students that have been detained by ICE in your school district. How are you educating children right now in your community? How are you responding to this? How are parents responding to this in Minnesota right now?
I'll tell you, there's really nothing normal about our daily lives at this point. This surge has been going on for a few weeks now, and it has really changed our standard operating procedures. We've staff have been working, you know, around the clock and overtime, walking children home. People have been donating different resources for us to get to the families. We do have an online option that families can select so that they children are learning from home. But let me stress that that is not the best practice. That is not what we want. We want our children in school, in their classrooms, with their teachers and with their classmates, because we know that that's what's best for children. We all learned that during COVID. But there's so much fear. And I'm not just talking about quote unquote illegal people. People who are here with legal documentation are fearful, as I think there have been many reports that ICE agents have taken citizens of the United States. So there are very many ICE agents right now in our community. They are driving around our schools, circling our schools. I've seen it with my own eyes. They are at our bus stops, following our buses, and they have been on my school property multiple times.
Zina Stenvik, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you. Let's get our kids back.
TikTok has closed a deal to keep the wildly popular video sharing app used by more than a billion people worldwide available in the U.S. The agreement caps a six-year legal and geopolitical fight after Congress passed a law requiring TikTok to divest from its Chinese parent company or face a nationwide ban.
The Trump administration says the deal protects American users from potential Chinese influence. But as Nick Schifrin reports, many national security experts argue it falls short.
I'm going to save TikTok.
Today on TikTok, a presidential victory dance.
L is for the way you look at me.
On the beloved video sharing app that the Trump administration has now saved for 200 million Americans.
You know you're getting a legit laboo-boo is not a lafoo-foo.
TikTok's viral sensations have combined access to music. With editing tricks made easy to create a social media monster.
I have a warm spot in my heart for TikTok.
And from one social media platform to another, President Trump announced a deal on Truth Social that TikTok US would be owned by, quote, a group of great American patriots and investors. A TikTok press release says that tech giant Oracle will house Americans' data and secure the TikTok US app, which will not have to be re-downloaded. TikTok US will, quote, retrain, test, and update the algorithm, although it will still be owned by Chinese parent company ByteDance. TikTok US's board of directors will be majority American, and the largest investors are Oracle, the Emirati firm MGX, and the American firm Silverlake, each of which owns 15%. ByteDance retains 19.9%. But the app's critics argue TikTok is built with an internal sleight of hand.
How are you doing that?
I got a Nimbus 2000.
That the app allows Beijing to manipulate content and steal Americans' data, even after today's announcement.
It's unilateral surrender to Beijing.
Michael Sobolik is a senior fellow at the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Hudson Institute.
The announcement says that the new U.S. TikTok will, quote, retrain, test, and update the algorithm. What's wrong with that?
The real concern here isn't the data that it's being trained on, it's what the algorithm is emphasizing or censoring. And Beijing is going to be the one that retains control over those decisions.
And that is not only a doomsday scenario in the future, there's a track record of TikTok doing this in recent years. In 2023, pro-Hamas content was boosted significantly on the app right after the October 7th attacks in Israel by Hamas. We are allowing ByteDance, it appears, to retain control over this all-important algorithm. That signals a lack of resolve and weakness on the administration's part that they're not taking national security as seriously as they should. The president got bad advice on this deal. I know he loves a good deal, but this is the art of the steal, not the art of the deal.
This deal says that U.S. users' data will be protected by Oracle. Oracle has run the cloud for the CIA, for the intelligence community, for many years. So what's wrong with that?
Remember that Oracle has already been serving TikTok in this way for the past 3 years. There's been numerous investigations from Forbes, from BuzzFeed, and other outlets that have demonstrated that ByteDance, again, a Chinese company, has gone to TikTok and requested U.S. user information data outside of normal channels. That is deeply concerning, and that happened under Oracle's watch.
But I spoke to some other technology experts today who wouldn't give me an interview on camera, but argued this deal does protect Americans. They say that there will now be multiple layers of oversight for American users' data, for the algorithm, and the TikTok app. And they argue this deal includes the U.S. government's most rigorous cybersecurity and data protection standards, which apply to no other social media company.
It's a great honor to be with a friend of mine, really for a long time now.
But critics of the president's China policy, who want him to confront Beijing, see TikTok as a symbol of the president's prioritizing deals over national security.
It says that our national security is for sale at the right price, which is a dangerous message to send to the ruler of the Chinese Communist Party.
U.S. officials dispute that.
To all of those young people of TikTok, I saved TikTok, so you owe me big.
And say national security concerns and the demands of hundreds of millions of users have now been answered. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
President Trump's remarks in Davos, Switzerland this week forced Western leaders to reevaluate their relationship with the U.S. That's as tensions escalated here at home over the ongoing immigration enforcement operations in Minnesota. For more, we turn tonight to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart of MS Now. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Jeff. Good evening.
So, David, what did we learn this week from President Trump's climb down on acquiring Greenland about his instincts, his sense of leverage, and the limits of his approach?
Well, he does have a method that he uses over and over again, which is to overreach, to offend everybody, and then back off. And he sort of did that. And that would be the benign explanation of what happened this week. The serious explanation is that this, I think, was probably the final break in the post-war international order, that we have taken it for granted that we in the West, as we call it, our democracies aligned and friends with each other. And what really struck me this week was how many European leaders, Mark Carney from Canada, how much pleasure they took in being bitterly breaking, divorcing with America, and that we're never going back to that. And I asked Europeans, like, is it like that Taylor Swift song, "We Are Never Getting Back Together"? And they said, yes, that's what it's like. We are never getting back together, because they say, you might elect a sane person in 2028, but you're always 4 years away from another one of these. And so they are really rethinking the whole global architecture. And it should be concerning to Americans, as Robert Kagan wrote in The Atlantic this week, we're going to look back on the Cold War with nostalgia, and we're going to look back on the post-Cold War world as if it was paradise. And that we're just entering, as Kagan wrote, the most dangerous time in American foreign policy since World War II.
Jonathan, should allies take some reassurance from the outcome that Trump ultimately backed off his tariffs and territorial demands, or concern about the way that it started?
I think the allies, particularly with Greenland, they understood what was happening. And I think, to David's point, this was the break. Going after Greenland, territory of Denmark, NATO ally, the president of the United States was willing to blow up NATO in order to get Greenland. And I watched the speech he gave at Davos with just my jaw on the ground for how many norm-busting things he said. And I kept going back to, again, to David's point about the Europeans thinking we're like one election away from this happening again. When Vice President Kamala Harris went to the Munich Security Summit, the first year of the Biden-Harris administration, she gave a speech. She sat down with the outgoing president, who asked, you know, President Biden says America is back. But the question is, for how long? Europeans have been wary of the United States since the first term of Donald Trump. And I think the speech by Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, to me, was the rhetorical break. Because what I heard from him in style and language, was all the things we're used to hearing from an American president, setting the table for what it means to be a global collective unit that is about as much about security as it is about mutual prosperity. And it was the Canadian prime minister who stood up for that, only to be threatened the next day by the president of the United States for saying the same, those exact words.
You mentioned Mark Carney, Canada's prime minister. Here he is in his own words.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. The middle powers must act together, because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu. We shouldn't allow the rise of hard power to blind us to the fact that the power of legitimacy, integrity, and rules will remain strong if we choose to wield them together.
A rupture, he says. And David, if governing by strength and spectacle is a defining feature of the Trump era, how sustainable is that approach for allies who are trying to manage this relationship for the next 3 years?
Yeah, well, it's governing by pure rancor. And, you know, Donald Trump has set out to create a world where gangsters can have free reign, and that the people who believe in the use of force above the rule of law, they should be able to run the show. And what's perverse about it is that he seems to have gone back to some sphere of influence idea from the 19th century, giving Russia that region, giving China that region, as long as we get to control our region. And this is simply, it's just an illusion to think you can take this approach and it won't lead to bloodshed. We've already seen since 2013, I think I mentioned this on the show some weeks before, that the number of people who died in war deaths from 1990 to 2013 was like 15,000 a year. After 2013, it surges to over 100,000 people a year. So we're always seeing a massive ramp up in bloodshed. And then when you get to where it's gangster versus gangster, we can expect that to continue or to exacerbate.
Well, while at Davos, the president launched what he's calling the Board of Peace. And the board's official mandate was to help oversee the Gaza Strip under an Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal brokered by the Trump administration last year, though the president has hinted at broader ambitions here. It's not exactly clear how this will all operate. And Jonathan, some allies worry that this board could undermine the UN. But could the opposite be true? Could this board, I mean, could the reason the board exists, could that be because the UN has struggled to adapt to modern conflicts and geopolitical realities?
I mean, maybe. Sure, a board of peace on paper sounds great. But who's on this board? And who created it? And who is going to be the person who can be the president of this board of peace long after he's no longer president of the United States? Donald Trump. You were just showing a moment ago, I believe it was the family photo of the people who were there on the board of peace. There's no France. There's no United Kingdom. There's no Western alliance. It's all potentates from the Middle East and Viktor Orban and other people who don't exactly care really about small d democracy and you know, liberal small d democratic values. So forgive me if I am not, you know, jumping for joy over the Board of Peace and what they're going to do for Gaza or do to Gaza.
How do you see it? I mean, are we in this moment where you have these sort of ad hoc coalitions replacing permanent institutions like the UN?
It could be. I mean, I'm one who believes that the Trump administration, going back to the Abraham Accords in the first term, was superior in regards to the Middle East than the Biden administration or the Obama administration's policies. And so I think they've done some good things in the Middle East. And if they can pour investments into Gaza, God bless them. I'm a little dubious they can do so with Hamas running Gaza and unwilling to step down. Who's going to want to invest? And so it is still a fact that you can call an international confab, but unless you actually prefer democracy and a place that will be stable, I'm very dubious that it's going to work.
Let's shift our focus stateside with what's happening in Minneapolis with the ICE enforcement. As we speak, there are thousands of people in the streets of Minneapolis protesting. We learned this week about an internal ICE memo that allows agents to enter people's homes without a judicial warrant. They're using administrative warrants. At what point does this aggressive enforcement start to undermine constitutional guardrails, Jonathan?
One could argue that it's already happening. that you have ICE, you know, busting into people's homes, snatching people off the streets, or as folks in Minneapolis are saying, people are being kidnapped, cars left in the middle of the road, sometimes still running with the possessions inside because ICE has snatched people off the street. I mean, what is happening in Minneapolis and Minnesota? It breaks my heart. Because we are seeing these constitutional norms that you're asking about being eroded before our very eyes, being not just challenged, but abused. That's the word I'm looking for, abused. When you look at a five-year-old who and his father who are in process, the asylum-seeking process, which means they are not undocumented, being used as bait, and then shipped to Texas with his father. Or Mr. Tao, the 57-year-old, who earlier in the week was hauled out of his home in boxer shorts and Crocs and a robe in 12-degree temperatures. I mean, what is happening to the people of Minneapolis, to American citizens? There was just a report today of a U.S. Army vet who was taken into custody for 8 hours there in Minneapolis. At some point, well, I was going to say the administration will have to see the error of its ways, but they will not. And this gets to the thing where I say my heart's broken, but my heart is full. Watching the protests in Minneapolis of people taking to the streets to stand up for their own constitutional rights, but to stand up for their communities and for their fellow folks who live in Minneapolis, because they. People should not have to live in fear the way that they're living there in Minneapolis right now. It's not, it's just at a moral level, how can anyone look at what's happening in Minneapolis and not stand up and not fight back and not push back? Because if it's happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a state that's 75% white, it's coming to you next, and it's already happening in Maine.
David, how does all of this strike you?
Yeah, the domestic analog of the foreign policy. It's a theory that we should rule by force. And I think what we've seen is a disillusion of the ideals of what democracy is supposed to be all about. And one of the things I'm curious about is how will the American people react? How are they reacting to the image of the five-year-old kid, Liam? And I think that we already know from polling that large majorities do not approve of what's going on. They think ICE is overbearing, cruel, and ruthless. But how much will they react? Will it cause a break in public opinion of the sort we haven't seen since the first Trump term? Maybe. You have to remember, I remember when I first started the conservative movement, there was a strong libertarian presence. And the single greatest thing they were talking about over and over again was federal troops violating due process rights, First Amendment rights, Bill of Rights. And this is exactly what's happening under the Republican Party. So there still is a libertarian element within the Republican Party. Are they going to say, what the heck? I did not sign up for this. And we'll see if that happens. But this is one of those issues. If there's ever going to be a break on the Trump coalition, I would think this would touch a chord.
David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, thanks to you both as always.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Measles, one of the world's most contagious diseases, was declared eliminated in the U.S. more than 25 years ago. Today, an outbreak that started last year is continuing, even as the U.S. officially ends its membership in the World Health Organization. Stephanie Tsai explores the ramifications and the reasons behind the outbreak.
Measles cases have been skyrocketing since last year. Take a look at this chart. In 2023, there were just 63 cases. That number quadruples by 2024 to more than 280 cases. Then last year, a huge spike, 2,240 cases. We're only 3 weeks into this new year, and already 416 cases have been confirmed. Outbreaks in South Carolina and along the Utah-Arizona border are jacking those numbers up. All this as vaccination rates continue to decline, and that accelerated during the COVID pandemic. Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University and author of Crisis Averted, The Hidden Science of Fighting Outbreaks, joins us now with more. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining the News Hour. So more than 200 measles cases were confirmed in just 1 week this month. Are these outbreaks likely to stay relatively local, or are we moving toward a point where the U.S. could see a widespread outbreak?
We are seeing that some of the larger outbreaks like that currently centered in South Carolina is being exported to other states. And the longer these outbreaks spread, the more opportunities there are for the virus to travel. That being said, public health officials are working very hard to contain them and stop transmission. But there have been a lot of cases in the last year, and I do expect that to continue in the year ahead.
Who is most vulnerable in these outbreaks?
People who are unvaccinated are by far the most vulnerable. Around 94% of cases found last year were in people who were unvaccinated. And so the strongest protection to prevent infection is that MMR vaccine.
We've been hearing from parents of babies who are getting measles. They are those that may not be vaccinated yet, or the vaccine may not have taken full effect yet. And then there's the question of the elderly and whether they should be getting vaccine boosters at this point. What do you think?
It's true that infants who are too young to be vaccinated, people who are immunocompromised, they're going to be at higher risk. And that's why it's so important that we as a community take all of the steps that we can to prevent transmission, because stopping transmission overall is the best way to protect those people. Now, older adults is a little bit of a different story. A few decades ago, it was the policy that people would only get one MMR vaccine. That provides about 94% protection from infection. That two dose, that second dose, brings up the level of protection to closer to 97-98%. So if you are older and you are considering getting a second vaccine or wondering if that's right for you, one thing you can do is ask your doctor to check your titers, check your blood, and see whether your immunity to measles is high enough. If not, they may offer you that second dose.
You talked about the local and state response to containing these outbreaks, but I want to talk about the federal impact. The chair of the Federal Advisory Panel on Vaccines, himself a pediatric cardiologist, has said in just the last few days that the polio and measles vaccines should be optional, including at schools. What is your reaction to that?
That's really not the role of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They do not have the power, and in fact, the entire CDC agency does not have the power to require anyone to get vaccinated. What they're meant to do is provide the best advice to the American people about how to keep themselves and their communities safe from infectious diseases, and I'd like to see them get back to that in 2026.
Is that the best advice, to make these vaccines that have long protected public health optional?
Absolutely not. There's no question that the measles vaccine, the polio vaccine, and in fact, the entire childhood vaccination schedule does good. It is good for people and communities because it prevents preventable infection. But what's at issue here, I think, is mandates. And I want to underscore that the federal government does not make vaccine mandates. They do not have that authority. And so I think it's a red herring to pit individual choice against vaccine recommendations, because individual choice is not an issue here.
We've heard quite often that decreasing vaccination rates can be attributed to vaccine hesitancy. But Caitlin, you've pointed out that equal attention should be paid to healthcare access and affordability. Expand on that.
There's no question that there is rising vaccine hesitancy, and I think we're right to think about that and to worry about that. But when you look at which demographic groups have lowest vaccine coverage, it is people who are uninsured. And so I think access and affordability needs to be on the agenda when we talk about ways to increase community vaccine coverage.
The U.S. at this point may be on the path toward losing what in your field is called measles elimination status. How big of a deal is that, and what would it mean?
It's really a sign that something has gone wrong in our public health system. Measles was eliminated in the United States in the year 2000, so it's been over 25 years of maintaining that elimination status, and I think we'll likely lose it in the year ahead. Now, I want to make the point that a vast majority of Americans are vaccinated and support vaccination, and so it's really this minority of people who are thinking about ways to erode our vaccine confidence and reducing community access. And unfortunately, we are seeing the effects of that. But I also want to contrast that with the point that vaccines are very popular.
The U.S. left the World Health Organization officially this week. I'm curious whether you think that might affect the measles outlook, either domestically or globally.
Measles is probably not top of the list of places where we will see the impact of our withdrawal from the World Health Organization. But regardless, it's clear that that is a move that will reduce the United States' preparedness for epidemics and pandemics. The WHO is a main way that we receive information about what is happening in the world, and we provide information and support as well. And so I think it's really a mistake to sever those ties.
That is Caitlin Rivers, an epidemiologist and author of Crisis Averted, The Hidden Science of Fighting Outbreaks, joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
In 1984, a shooting on a New York City subway thrust Bernard Goetz into the center of the national spotlight. After opening fire on four black teenagers he said were trying to rob him, Goetz was hailed by some as a vigilante hero in a city gripped by fear and rising crime, and condemned by others as a symbol of racial violence. The case unfolded against the backdrop of New York's turbulent 1980s, when public anxiety about safety collided with enduring questions about race, justice, and the limits of self-defense. In Five Bullets, Elliot Williams, a former federal prosecutor and legal analyst, revisits the shooting, the trial that followed, and the cultural moment that turned a single act of violence into a referendum on American law and society. I spoke with him recently about the book. Elliot Williams, welcome to the NewsHour.
Oh, thank you so much for having me here, Jeff.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this book revisits a case that many Americans remember in broad strokes as the subway vigilante.
Right.
40 years later, why did this whole story feel so urgent to return to?
Right. It's lived in my head for quite some time. I grew up, as you did, in New Jersey and remember this quite well from all over the headlines and the nightly television every night. I think we are still living with many of the issues that are central to the book Five Bullets. It's polarization, media bias, but also race and crime, and how much society tolerates or even encourages vigilante behavior. So there's lots of threads in the world we live in, and it just felt too ripe to pass up.
And the notion of fear, how does this entire episode reveal how fear operates in not just law, but public opinion?
Sure. Well, fear is one of the greatest motivators of human behavior. It's one of the few things that links all of us as human. Everybody experiences fear in some way. Now, the fear drives how laws are written and enforced. At the center of this case is the question of the legitimacy of Bernard Goetz's fear. How afraid was he, and did that entitle him to use lethal force against these four black teenagers? And in general, fear drives a lot of, I used the words media bias earlier, fear drives clicks on social media and headlines that newspapers put up, which has an effect on how people see the world. So all of these things fit together, and fear often is at the center of it.
And you place Goetz in the long tradition of American vigilantism. Why does this idea of the armed citizen taking matters into his own hands, why does this loom so large in the American imagination?
Right. So going back to the country's founding, the idea of individual defense or self-defense or public defense has been really part of what makes America America, whether folks want to agree with that or not. It's enshrined in the Constitution. The country won its independence after a very vicious civil war. And violence, oddly, and perhaps at times tragically, is who we are as Americans. Now, there's a long tradition of Americans almost making a fantasy or fetish out of vigilantes, from films like Death Wish, which really Bernard Goetz gets called the Death Wish vigilante by the New York Post, and that becomes his nickname, to the way that society lifts up men, usually white men, who engage in vigilante behavior. Kyle Rittenhouse was more of a celebrity than many people at the time on account of engaging in behavior that one could quite confidently call vigilante behavior, stepping out to protect society with violent force. And so it really is baked into who we are as Americans. And Bernard Goetz in 1984 was probably one of the earliest modern big television nightly news American experience examples of it.
We'll say more about that. How did media coverage at the time amplify that case in a way that distorted the reality instead of clarifying it.
Sure. I have an entire chapter in Five Bullets about Rupert Murdoch's takeover of the New York Post in 1970, I believe it was six, where he'd had a bunch of tabloid newspapers in other cities and other countries and really wanted a big city tabloid to compete with. He got the New York Post and really shifted the coverage of the Post to focusing on the most sensational aspects of crime. Woman found in bathtub and guns and fear and a night of terror and everybody's screaming. And those were in 3-inch headlines, the kinds of headlines you'd see in the New York Post all the time. And they sold very, very well. In New York, the Daily News and Newsday, other tabloids people would read every single day, would sort of follow suit. And it became an arms race in the 1980s to have the most sensational, most violent, most shocking headlines. That's all really largely how people consumed their news. And by the end of it, everybody was scared. Everybody was buying more newspapers, then getting more scared. And it was just a culture of fear that pervaded New York and really a lot of America.
You interviewed Bernard Goetz for this book. What surprised you the most about how he sees himself in that day all these years later?
Right. He regards himself as having committed an act of public service. And I asked him that question, and he's almost proud or indignant about how the appropriateness of his actions. So that was something that stunned me. I would have thought that even if he did not feel he was guilty of a crime and he was acquitted of violent crime charges in 1987, even if he didn't feel he was guilty, I would have thought there might have been some self-reflection, and there was absolutely none, number one. Number two, I was shocked the extent to which he, speaking to a black man, was willing to not use ethnic slurs or really go there, but to say things that would not be acceptable in mixed company. I was just shocked by his comfort and looseness in speaking with him. And then, I guess three, he's obsessed with the 1980s. Mario Cuomo came up more in this conversation than with anybody I've talked about in a long time. He's just obsessed with liberal leaders, the 1980s, and how the fat cats and the politicians and the media are all in cahoots and aligned against us.
This book humanizes an event often described and discussed in abstractions.
Yeah.
What do you want readers to carry forward from the story?
That I want readers to carry forward that all stories are more complex. I approached this as a journalist, not an advocate or activist or whatever else, and I approached it wanting to create a three-dimensional look at this immensely polarizing story. And so, for instance, Jeff, you mentioned my conversation with Bernard Goetz, which many might have taken issue with the fact that I even sat down with Bernard Goetz. Now, he does not come across sympathetically in this book at all. He's not the hero of this story, but he comes across as three-dimensional. And I made every effort to make him three-dimensional while pointing out the big warts I saw with him as an individual and his actions. Same thing with the young men, who certainly had at times horrific or ugly criminal histories, but we're human beings with families and lives, and I wanted that to come through and signify that even if they had troubled past or criminal histories or whatever else, that did not entitle anyone to take violent force against them under nebulous circumstances or confusing circumstances. So everything is just more complex than we remember it to be when we were young.
Five Bullets, the story of Bernie Goetz, New York's explosive 80s, and the subway vigilante trial that divided the nation. Elliot Williams, great to speak with you. Thanks for being here.
Always great to talk to you, Jeff. Thanks.
As always, there's a lot more online, including the potential effects of President Trump's efforts to ban large investment firms from purchasing single-family homes. That's on our YouTube page.
And be sure to watch Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight on PBS. Moderator Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel assess the war of words between President Trump and Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney.
And on The Next Horizons, hosted by our own William Brangham, a report from a glacier the size of Florida and why the scientists there are going to extreme measures to study it. And on Compass Points, Nick Schifrin and his panel discuss the consequences of President Trump's aggressive efforts to acquire Greenland. You can check your local listings for Horizons and Compass Points or tune in on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And that is the NewsHour for tonight and this week. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us. Have a good weekend.